Wonderful, majestic world around us, it's time for Dear Science. Thanks to MOTAT, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.
So, this week on Dear Science, we have Alan Blackman. Kia ora, Alan. Thanks for being here today.
Hi, Francis. It's good to have, I guess, yet another host of The Wire. I'm going through these at quite a rate of knots, I guess, now. Over the years we've been doing this, yeah.
Cool. Hey, let's start with the first story. I've had to practice saying this one a little bit. Neuroprosthesis.
Perfect.
Tell us what it is and what's happened.
Well, this is absolutely astonishing. I sort of read this in various stages of disbelief. These are researchers at the University of California in San Francisco, and what they have managed to do is, as you say, they've developed a thing called a speech neuroprosthesis. Now, we normally think of sort of prostheses as being sort of artificial legs, artificial arms, those sorts of things. But this is artificial speech through the brain, essentially. A speech neuroprosthesis is essentially just what that means. So what these people are trying to do, and what they seem to have succeeded in doing, is to actually decode the signals that go from the brain to the vocal tract, and then they are able to display those, or decode those signals and display them as words. And, you know, this is absolutely astonishing.
My goodness,
absolutely incredible.
Yeah.
So what they have done is that they've got a unfortunately severely paralyzed patient. So he's in his late 30s. He's been paralyzed for about 15 or so years. He had a brainstem stroke, and unfortunately that damaged the connection between the brain and the vocal tracts and the brain and his limbs. So he's severely paralyzed and he can't speak as a result of that. So what they wanted to do with him was to see if they could get him to attempt to talk, even though his vocal tract doesn't let him talk, but to actually go through the process of talking. So therefore, you know, his brain is then signaling his vocal tract to say particular words or letters or whatever. And so obviously what they needed to be able to do in order to even have a chance of this succeeding is to be able to deconvolute those signals from the brain, or figure out in the first instance whereabouts in the brain these signals are coming from. So what he had done over, or the leader of this research had done over about a 10-year period, was to work with epilepsy patients. And they had electrodes planted in their brain to try and figure out the source of their epileptic episodes. And so they agreed to help him in his research as to, you know, whereabouts in the brain these signals are coming from to control the voice. And so 10 years of data on that, and they sort of figured out that, yes, we know now where these signals are coming from. Now can we possibly decode those signals once we know that these are the ones we're looking for, okay?
Because all sort of previous communication for those suffering from paralysis has been done through sort of hand signals and writing.
Absolutely, yeah, right? Yeah. And that's the thing with this guy. So the patient is called Bravo One, and the way that he communicates is he's got a little pointer on a cap, and he can move his head, so he will point out particular letters, you know, and make words that way. And obviously, you know, that's far from ideal. But it does let him communicate in such a way to allow his participation in this particular research, because he can then say, yes, this is what I was trying to say, or no, this is not what I was trying to say. So basically, long story short, what they did was they gave him a brain implant and in the correct place, and then they presented him with a list of 50 words, and they told him, okay, try and say these 50 words, and we're going to monitor your activity in the brain that is going to your vocal cortex, and we'll see what we can do with that. So basically he had to agree to getting implants in his brain, which he did, which is absolutely fabulous. And then they got 22 hours of data from this, from him trying to say these 50 words, 48 sessions and several months. So you can imagine that this is just an enormous, enormous task for this guy. You know, this is just so far above and beyond, it's not funny. And so then they had 22 hours of data, which they then had to decode. So they're just looking at electrical impulses, essentially, because that's, you know, that's what your brain is doing. So And they could figure out what impulses accounted for which particular vowels, which particular consonants, and then they got to these words, these 50 words. And they would then say, right, you know, say this word, and then they could again eventually get to the point where they'd say, right, that signal belongs to that word. We can deconvolute that. And they're using artificial intelligence, all this incredible bloody stuff. And they eventually have got to the situation now where they've got a 75% success rate in determining the correct words.
My goodness, that's incredible.
And they can do 18 words an hour. Now, that doesn't sound like a hell of a lot, but my God, when you figure out or consider what is going into this, you know. And
for a guy that hasn't been able to speak as well for so long.
Absolutely. And, and there was no guarantee that this would work because, you know, he hadn't been using his vocal cortex for, or his vocal tract for, you know, for 15 years because he'd been paralyzed for that long. So there was absolutely no guarantee about this. And, you know, this is the sort of really, really long-term research that would probably find difficulty getting funded, because these days sort of scientific funding, you know, they want results yesterday sort of thing. And you know, this is years and years and years of research. Yeah. And I think this is an utterly, utterly extraordinary story, this. And, you know, hopefully this can go on and help people down the track, because I find this absolutely incredible.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
Amazing.
Hey, let's talk about something else that's years and years and years, which is this evolutionary effect of, excuse that, of the weather on our brain and body size.
Yeah, yeah, and this is really interesting too. Who would have thought that, that the weather would have such an influence on our body size? Now, Homo sapiens, that's us, and we are much, much bigger than our ancestors, than our other Homo ancestors. And the question is then why? And, you know, what factors could be important in determining this? So a bunch of workers at Cambridge University and Tübingen University in Germany have studied over 300 fossils, okay? And these fossils are of various ages, all the way back to about a million or so years ago. And they come from all around the planet. So they've got a sort of a wide variety of these. And what they did was that they were studying various aspects of these fossils, size, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And they were looking at them in concert with sort of climate models as to what the climate would have been when these particular folk were around on planet Earth. And what they found was a definite strong correlation between size and the temperature. And it might go the other way than what you think, but the colder it gets, the bigger we get.
Wow. I would have thought the other way.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. Exactly. That sort of goes against sort of the common sense sort of interpretation of it is. But that's what they found. Now the reason for this, and it does make sense, is that the bigger you get, the more heat you put out. Okay. But your surface area doesn't increase as much as your volume does. Okay, when you get bigger, your volume increases as a cubic relationship, whereas your surface area increases as a squared relationship. So your volume gets much bigger much faster than does your surface area. So if you're going to lose heat, the bigger you are, the better you are, okay, because you don't lose proportionately as much heat, okay. And that's why, like things like hummingbirds, they, you know, go like the absolute clappers, and they've got to eat continuously because they're so small and they're just sort of radiating heat. But the bigger you are, the less heat you proportionately lose. And so again, something like polar bears. So if you've ever seen a polar bear in real life, they're enormous, bloody great things, and they're way bigger than your sort of your brown bears and your black bears and grizzly bears and things like that. Again, very probably because of that reason, the fact that, you know, they're in cold climates and so they're bigger and so they proportionately are going to lose less heat. They're generating more heat and losing less of it. So that's what these guys came to in terms of body size. They're also looking at the size of the brains as well and seeing if they could find any correlation between climate and brain size. And they didn't in this case. So there seems to be no correlation between temperature and brain size. But there was a some sort of correlation between precipitation, of all things, rainfall, and net primary production. So in other words, how verdant everything was, you know, whether you're getting lots of crops and everything. And that possibly makes a bit of sense. You could possibly rationalize that. But the correlation in that case wasn't so strong. But certainly Yeah, definitely the colder it gets, the bigger we become.
Fascinating. So, yeah. Hey, I haven't seen a polar bear in real life, but there is another thing that I'd really like to see in real life, and that is this exploding 8-ton whale. I've been sort of sitting watching the video all morning.
Oh,
tell us.
Oh.
Francis, you'd want to see an exploding whale.
Oh, my God. If I was given the opportunity, I wouldn't say no.
Well, look, I have to say this isn't quite exactly science, but I couldn't let this sort of pass because I did find it yesterday. So let's intro this by saying that New Zealand has one of the highest rates of whale strandings in the world. Mm-hmm. And so every year it seems Golden Bay, Farewell Spit, all around there, the pilot whales go and bloody beach themselves and all those good people there go out and try and rescue them. And it's really, really tragic. And I hate to sort of say that and then go into something that's obviously humorous, but this is the thing that the internet was invented for, and this is an old, this is an old video, which was, up until very, very recently, grainy and really, really difficult to see. But now, somebody has gone and made a sort of a 4K reproduction of this, and now it's as clear as a bell. So anybody out there who hasn't seen this, you need to go and see this right now, because it is absolutely classic. There was an 8-ton whale in 1970 that beached on the coast of Oregon. And nobody knew how to get rid of it. It was of such a size that you couldn't really bury it very easily. And nobody sort of wanted to cut it up or anything like that. And so somebody had the bright idea of putting half a ton of dynamite underneath it, blowing it to smithereens. Yes. And then, quote unquote, the seagulls and the crabs and stuff would then eat the small remainder of... of this 8-ton whale.
Blasting blubber.
As you will see in the video, things didn't really go to plan, and a car got crushed by exploding
whale meat. Yeah. Oh, my.
And the voiceover in this is just hilariously deadpan. It's just fantastic stuff. Those of you who haven't seen it, go and Google right now, Exploding Whale Remastered on YouTube. And you will laugh. It is just absolutely hilarious.
You're in for a real treat if you do that. Maybe not while you're having your lunch, though.
Possibly, yeah.
Hey, thanks so much, Ellen.
Thank you.
Yeah, we'll see you in a couple of weeks.
Absolutely. Thanks, guys.
Have a lovely day.
You too.
Well, I didn't know that before. Dear Science, thanks to MOTAT, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.